You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Okay, we're going to get started. Tim is looking with a dumbfounded look in his face. Grant, but he'll be here. He's expected here, and when he gets here, we'll let him jump right in. I'll make sure I ask the hardest questions of Grant to punish him for that. Okay. My name is Tom Galvin. I'm a partner with 463 Communications. I want to thank everyone for coming today and being part of the conference, and particularly this panel. I want to thank our panelists, the Honorable Derek White from the UK Parliament, Ambassador David Gross, who is the United States Coordinator for International Communications and Information Policy. And fortunately, I took his card beforehand. Professor Graham from the Oxford Internet Institute, and Brian Cute, Vice President of Government Relations for VeriSign. The name of this panel is potentially interesting for some because people hear the internationalization of the Internet, and they may think, well, I thought the Internet was already international. And it is, and that's really what we're getting at. The Internet started, obviously, what became the Internet 35 years ago and was developed among technicians and technical folks from several countries. But in many respects, they were like-minded people. For one, primarily, they all spoke English. Two, they came from Western cultures. And three, they had worldviews in those cultures that were similar in terms of customs and issues of freedom and content and freedom of speech. And that was the folks who initially developed it. And so the Internet started, actually, pretty much with one language and those types of worldviews. Now it's global and pervasive, and the worldview that spawned it is bumping into cultures that have differences of opinion about what kind of content should be online, what access citizens should have to certain things. And by the way, that's not only true in China, but also in the United States and every other country. And that has also led, at times, to tension about the U.S. historical role as the backstop of the Internet. The United States played a role as the facilitator of ICANN. The ICANN contract, the MOU, was done through the Department of Commerce. The IANA function and those components were used as a U.S. backstop. In the last few years, we've seen calls by some countries and some international bodies that the Internet governance, the role of overseeing the Internet, should be done more globally and should be out of the hands in terms from a backstop position of the U.S. government and should be put into maybe the United Nations or the ITU or some other entity that would do that. So we're going to talk about those things today. I'm going to put our panelists on the spot, and I hope they won't hate me afterwards. We'll also talk a little bit about China and the role that we're seeing in specifically China is a very good case study now of folks who have a bit of a different view about what kind of content citizens should have access to. And we're going to ask these folks questions, and I'm going to ask them questions, but I'm also going to encourage the audience to be ready and willing to throw questions at our panelists. And after one or two questions that we get started up here, I'm going to turn to, if there's any folks in the audience who want to say it, ask questions as well. So that's where we're going to start, and I'm going to actually lead off with Derek, if you don't mind. And I'm going to ask you, should the United States relinquish its historical role as the backstop of the Internet?
Well, I don't think there's any demand for that. But I sense there's a deeper sort of question that you're asking. Let me try and ask you to think differently today, at least for the next 5 minutes. The institutions that we created after the Second World War largely favor the Western powers, whether that's the United Nations, the WTO, the IMF, or the World Bank. Do you think that's appropriate for the 21st century? I just want you to reflect on that. And therefore, isn't it understandable that there is some concern outside of America about America? And of course, at the moment, it's been focused down a little bit on the WSIS discussions on, to be honest, rather a tiny part of internet governance issues called ICANN. But there's nothing wrong with ICANN. It works very well, and we should leave it alone.
Okay. Anybody else want to jump in there?
Yeah, I'll come in. In a way, a bit like Derek, I think there's an underlying question. And I'd like to come at it in a variety of ways. One is to say the political scientists in the room are probably very familiar with the distinction that Joe Nye draws between hard power and soft power. Hard power is to do with military power. Soft power works through persuasion. Well, clearly the politics of the internet have to be the almost ultimate soft power. And it started off in that sort of way, and it should continue in that sort of way. And the most important thing that the US should do is not say, I mean, and I'm speaking as a friend from England, you know, sharing many of the values, it should not say that ICANN is a US institution. It's got to be located somewhere. It's got to be under some jurisdiction. It happens to be in California. But it isn't, as Vint Cerf said, a government organization. Mm-hmm. And what we want is the internet to be, if it's run by anything, it's got to be run by that mix of things that we would put under the heading of civil society. There's got to be, a government's got to be on the side there, because there are some things that do bump into government. But there's a private sector playing, there are NGOs playing, there are universities playing, there are citizens playing, consumers playing, they're all in there. So the question, either in terms of the root servers or ICANN, don't call it the US. That's the strongest piece of advice. It isn't the US's. It isn't owned by the US. It's located there. Everything's got to be located somewhere, even in cyberspace.
So let me follow up. Do you feel currently from a, when you hear U.S. policymakers and thought leaders talk about this, they talk about it as if it's U.S. owned?
Occasionally. There's been a bit of a reaction to because of the Tunis situation mm-hmm. and because of China. A bit of a tendency suddenly to start saying that this is sort of a big U.S. government issue. And I think what's happened is, at least I'm, you know, other people in the room know much more about this, and I'll ask what the ambassador thinks in a minute. He'd be able to speak this much more informed than me. But my perspective is that it's suddenly sort of, in terms of the US administration, the internet governance, which was kind of somewhere down here for a bit, has suddenly gone like this. And it's in that sort of rapid curve phase that things can go wrong and the messages don't get through. I think it's very important that the messages get through at the top level. This thing is, broadly speaking, working. I mean, one of the questions we were asked was, can the internet become international and become fragmented? And the answer is to both questions, it is international, and it has fragmented, and both are good news. And I can explain both the internationalization and the fragmented bit. I mean, just the internationalization. I was in trekking in a little tiny village called Pokhara about 2 or 3 years ago. And the guide had his own email address and shared a website with various other guides in Nepal. So it's internationalized for sure, and it's localized. And it's fragmented. I mean, the US approach to websites is different from that to Middle East countries, which is different to China. And that's fine. I can do the bad news bit if you like, but that's the good news. I'll do the bad news bit later, but one question at a time.
So I got plenty of questions here. I can go all day. But if there's folks who do want to ask questions, you can go to the mic at a point, and we'll start to get that in. David, I want to follow up. Does the US think they own the internet?
Absolutely no. And I'm trying to think of even how you can get around that. I don't know anybody who thinks that's actually the case anymore. I think, though, that there are a number of levels that we need to sort of be aware of, because it would be easy for me to sort of say no, and we don't think it, and we don't say it anymore, we try not to, and sort of be done with it. But I do think that would be a little misleading. So, for example, in terms of the administration, we don't speak of either owning the internet or even controlling ICANN in the way that is traditionally, I think that term is traditionally used. Now, having said that, we point out, and our standard talking points are always things about the majority of the board members of ICANN are non-Americans. It's the CEO is a non-American, blah, blah, blah. I think everybody in this room probably knows, at least hopefully know all those talking points. And I could sort of end there, but I think it would be a little misleading if I just ended there, because what we have in addition said that leads to some criticism, but it's where we are, is that we think that, we said publicly, we think, as a government, we think ICANN has done a good job. We've also said in our four principles that we issued at the end of June of this past year that we would continue to exercise oversight over ICANN in order to ensure the reliability and stability. That is, the concept, I think the term privatization has often been used in a variety of ways. Try to move away from that, but that's not a very helpful word, because everyone seems to read into it a lot more than what other people read into it, but whatever it is, but really sort of talk a little bit more precisely about what it is that we do and what we don't do. And I think, as the question indicates, that there's a lot of misinformation there. There's a lot of overstatement and sometimes, frankly, even understatement about what the role of the United States government is. I would say that, you know, clearly we play a role with regard to the IANA contract. Clearly we have an MOU with ICANN. We think that those are all good things because they breed both responsibility and reliability and stability to something that everyone agrees is very important.
Great.
I'd like to welcome Grant Aldana. That's fine.
Welcome, Grant.
Thank you for joining. Grant is at Akin Gump and a former Commerce Department official, particularly focused on trade issues, if I've accurately described you.
Absolutely.
And we're going to come back and ask you some China questions shortly, if you don't mind.
Great.
I think there's a question at the mic, so let's go there.
Thank you. My name's Becky Burr, and since Ira Magaziner's not here, I'll say it's my fault. But I think that I want to follow up on what Ambassador Gross was saying, because you have all referred to the U.S. role as a backstop. I think that if we were clearer about what it meant to be a backstop and under what circumstances the U.S. government would intervene, it would be very helpful to the rest of the world to understand what I believe is a more limited role than some people may think. And so I agree with Ambassador Gross that there may be some misinformation, but it would be very useful to have the government say clearly what it means to be a backstop and the circumstances under which it would act.
Do you think that would really make a difference?
I think it would make a huge difference.
The reason I ask is that, you know, my experience, I was the Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade, and wherever I went to talk about these issues, to be honest with you, the assumptions about the United States and everything we say are so deeply ingrained, the misapprehensions about what the role of the U.S. government is and about its involvement, that as many times as David could get up and speak the truth to power, the truth as he sees it, I never saw it have any purchase with many of the people out there who would prefer to see the role of the U.S. government as something broader, more comprehensive, and frankly more conspiratorial than is in fact the case with respect to the Internet.
Well, I do think that there is a bit of a conspiratorial feeling surrounding it, but I actually think that we've created that by not being very clear. And I can tell you that we sat around a table with a lot of people from around the world to put this together, and it wasn't with any conspiracy in mind. I mean, we mix up the IANA functions contract and the MOU with ICANN, which are just sort of things that are there for the transition with the control over the route. I think you have to get to addressing the what it means to have that backstop authority over the route, clearly, and there will be differences of opinion about that. But I think if we could isolate in the sort of clearest and most narrow terms what it is we're about, and the circumstances under which that would authority would be exercised, and the circumstances under which we would consult and collaborate before doing that, that was the spirit we entered into this with, and I think it would get us back a far ways.
If what I said to you is that I've heard David talk in these groups, and I've seen the response, and I know that he has articulated exactly what you've described in as many settings
but
as possible.
I'll tell you, I haven't heard the circumstances under which the U.S. government would exercise its unilateral control over the
can I give you a different viewpoint entirely? If two-thirds of the world's population don't understand the word private industry or don't have a stock market, then they confuse the fact that the government does everything for you. And therefore, in their complex sociology, they assume that therefore that happens in America too. It's much more complex out there.
Well, I'm going to sit down because I'm not a panelist.
So,
but I do want to say, let's just start with our friends, okay? Not the two-thirds of the world that has the government manage their lives. Let's be clear with our friends in Europe and Japan and Australia about that. So,
but in fairness, Becky, I'm sorry.
Please.
But I've heard that. And the irony is that there's little receptivity, although I know that U.S. government officials, and this is regardless of party affiliation, have been very clear in the things that I've attended about what the true role of the U.S. government is, but I don't feel any traction among even our friends in that context, to be honest.
Okay, well,
so we're gonna.
I don't know what the role. I don't know what you think the role is.
I want to follow up on the private sector part and the conspiracy part for a question for Brian Cute. As a private sector entity, are you part of a U.S. government conspiracy?
It's actually worse than that.
No. So, do you get that when it, you know, VeriSign plays a stewardship role with the root server operator, root server, and .com and .net? What do you get from a standpoint of being a private sector operator that is an internationalized, you know, company in many respects that is U.S. based?
Well, I, having attended the WSIS proceedings last year with a broader business constituency from the U.S., I did feel in somewhat of a unique position. I mean, VeriSign has a contract with the U.S. government in part for what it does in operating the root servers that we operate, the A and the J root. We also have a contract with ICANN. So I have to say, in all honesty, attending those meetings and circulating and talking with folks offline and just reading the room, I began to feel that there was yet another axis of evil that I didn't know about, and I was part of it. but that being said, I think there's another perspective, and I really welcome Derek's opening question about stepping back and thinking about institutions, because the experience of going through that process as a business was interesting from this viewpoint. It was unique in that we were sitting in a room full of diplomats, and with all due respect to Ambassador Gross, the diplomats were getting educated on technology. And that is a very scary thing when you sit back and think about it. It can be a very dangerous thing. But as business, coming from the U.S. and coming from the ICANN structure, where we are immediately and involved in the processes on equal footing with all the other participants, we were definitely sitting at the back of the bus. And that was the other distinct perception during the WSIS process, that business was at the back of the room. And thanks for coming along, but we at the front of the room are going to make all the decisions here. Now, the U.S. government worked very diligently with us, and as well as the EU. I mean, we had interactions with our friends in the EU, and they listened to us and did what they could to bring a business perspective forward. But back to Derek's question about institutions, we've been looking at it as business from a standpoint of, hey, we're business. We help build this infrastructure. We make the investments. Our voice should be factored in here. Thrust into a context where we're in the back of the bus and thinking, my God, how in the Internet Governance Forum or in the ITU can we change this equation and get ourselves at the table on equal footing? I think Derek's actually asked a question from a different point of view, and it's a conversation worth having.
But we would like to offer you, I've talked to my parliamentary colleagues, and Andrew's, well, together we founded the Oxford Internet Institute, is we think there are four constituencies that we should look at. One is the academic, one is the politician, one is the private industry, and one is the consumer. And we think if we're going to have a proper conversation, we need to have some sort of global think tank that looks at these issues. And the challenge is we'd like to invite you to Oxford next year to have that discussion so that we invite the politicians and the academics and the private sector and the consumer, who's, you know, Ian Taylor, my colleague this morning, was saying, consumer's king. Well, they are. But where are they represented, any of these bodies, anywhere? We need another model, and the internet should enable it. And we've got to give that thought. And if you're nervous about the WSIS sort of internet forum bit, fine, but why don't we be the think tank for that? Why don't we write the papers? Why don't we collect? Why don't we start to think it? Why don't we challenge them? So it's not seen as an American thing. It's seen just as people connecting. And that's what we'd like to do.
David, did you have a follow-up to that?
Well, actually, no other than to endorse the idea of having multi-stakeholder approach, which, of course, you know, we support very, very strongly and took a lot of grief for supporting so very strongly, whether it's in the WSIS process or otherwise. Now, what I was going to try to do was to sort of square the circle a little bit of the colloquy we had just a moment ago to point out, I think, Grant, of course, is exactly right. We have had these discussions. We continue to have these discussions. I think we've been abundantly clear. In fact, we've been criticized for speaking so undiplomatically clear about these things. Having said that, I think that then suggests that what we're really doing is we're having a discussion about certain things, and we're calling it ICANN, we're calling it IANA, we're calling it Internet Governance, and we're really having a discussion about a very different thing. and that is the role of the U.S. generally in the world economy, mm-hmm. and what are the advantages and what are the disadvantages. That's a much more complex, and that's why Grant is so expert on this, because he's lived that for many years now. And so in order to really understand what it is, I think you have to peel the onion in order to really have a better sense of what is surrogates and what are reality. I know I'm probably overstating it when I say that I think if most people really look at the reality, there's not a lot to get excited about when it comes to internet governance, but there's a lot of excitement. And so I think in order to understand that and not just ignore it or to dismiss it, you have to understand what's really, what the dynamics are. And therefore, I think what my colleagues are saying is so powerful, which is we invite that discussion. We invite those dialogues. We invite that discussion that we always have. We very much want to, especially with close colleagues, but also even with those who strongly disagree with where we've been.
We're going to let Professor Graham say a word, and then we're going to let this very patient woman get in.
Sorry. I'll try and keep this pretty short. I don't know whether you remember, you used to walk around in London, you'd see those artists, and they'd have these things on the street, and they'd say, all my own work. Now, as an academic, I know that's completely ridiculous. and I just wanted to say that because I did manage to get the money and set up the thing called the Oxford Internet Institute, but I'm drawing all the time on what my colleagues in Oxford have been doing. And we held a forum about internet governance, drawing on exactly the set of people that Derek's been talking about, people from the US, UK, Europe, Far East, private sector, NGOs, all that kind of stuff. And I want to say that I don't think it's true that all of these bodies in civil society should be playing the same role at all stages. In some extent, what the Oxford Forum came up with, it almost more or less reinvented, maybe people have been reading that book a long time ago, but reinvented the book that I think was written by Dave Clark, the famous hourglass figure that most people in this room know. You know, that there's the little tiny bit, which is the protocols, TCP/IP, in the middle. Underneath, there's the operating system, and on top are all the applications. And this, the reason that these guys were so incredibly clever at the beginning in getting the internet ever to be created was they made this bit in the middle bit incredibly simple. And that's how they were able to get agreement. And that's how it's been scalable. And that bit is pretty technical. And I don't think it's sensible to think that that's something that's done by voting. You know, okay. That's engineering. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And you want to keep that bit on the whole, as operating within very close to that kind of range in operating the domain name system. Of course, there are bits where suddenly ICANN's wondering whether to have a 3X, and that's a sort of quasi-policy issue. Yeah? And so there are times when ICANN wants to have its advisory board and bring in other people, but there's that little narrow bit in the middle. There are other bits where all of a sudden it widens out, and it becomes like almost any other policy issue, and we shouldn't necessarily think of the internet as very special. But, I mean, I said a moment or two ago, and I'm very sorry to the lady there, I didn't say I was doing the good news bit. Let me do the quick bad news bit. The internet is international, and it's fragmented, and that's but good news. But its very ubiquity is its vulnerability, and its scale is its vulnerability. You know, we're all talking about 800 to a billion users, but remember, in addition, there are something like 15 to 20 million programmers out there. Yeah? And they're not, by definition, all nice. 15 to 20 million of them. That's a lot of people. And so the consumer, we have a danger that all this thing is functioning pretty well. You know, if this doesn't go down very much and your inbox doesn't crash, mine does occasionally, not too bad. But there is a real danger that with this incredible quantity of people using the system, if it starts to go wrong, seriously wrong, that there will be a backlash and recall for massive kinds of regulation. And I think what we've got to be working on now is how to reduce the vulnerability. And I'll say more about that later, but that lady's been waiting a long time.
If you can remember your question, please give it.
Thank you. I can. I am wondering, this question is for Ambassador Gross and for our two friends in the UK. If you could explain to me, I'm wondering during the negotiations, when you're trying to explain the distance for the U.S. government from internet policy in ICANN, when the U.S. Congress, Senator Coleman and representatives and other senators put forward resolutions about U.S. control over ICANN, is that helpful or harmful? Can you just explain how that played out?
For us, it was extraordinarily helpful.
As we were talking with colleagues from many countries around the world, it brought home to me how extraordinarily knowledgeable, in part because of the internet, at least diplomats are about the U.S. system. They understand the power and the importance. What they were particularly struck by was how bipartisan the view was about the traditional role the U.S. government has played with regard to these areas, and particularly because the people who were speaking were so knowledgeable, and there was a recognition about that. And so when I talked about our four principles, and I talked about the sorts of things that we were very interested in working with colleagues about, and the very narrow areas where we said basically that was non the sort of thing we negotiate with diplomats about in a summit. That's just not appropriate. It's not reasonable. That, I think, ultimately hit a fairly responsive chord because people understood very well what the domestic politics were, whether it was from the Hill, whether it was President Bush saying it, whether or not it was Secretary Rice saying it, Secretary Gutierrez saying it, and so forth. And that was, I think, very, very helpful and very important, ultimately, in how it all came out.
So we're going to get to your question, but bear with us for 1 second. I want to turn a little bit to China. On a lot of different levels, China's in the news these days. The several Western technology companies will be testifying in the next couple of weeks about sales of equipment to China. And so I want to talk about that for a second and get folks' views. Grant is someone who's spent a fair amount of time on China trade issues particularly. I'd be curious, would a Western, quote, boycott, meaning Western company boycott, of Internet gear to China have an impact? Would it affect the way they view Internet freedoms and content, or would it have an adverse effect?
It would have zero effect. If what you're talking about is an embargo of the gear itself, let's be honest, most of the stuff is manufactured there already in one form or another, so an embargo from outside is not going to have an impact on the Chinese ability to make use of the net. Equally important, you know, for China, like any society, you may not like the government and its policies, but there are certain issues that where economics will be sacrificed on the altar of politics, security, whatever it might be. In the case of communist China, there is going to be an interest in controlling information. Now, ultimately, you have to think about what's your relationship with China, what's your obvious goal. And the irony there is that as little as I like the ISPs collaborating with the Chinese government in censorship, I have great faith, based on my experience with individual Chinese, that we're far better off with Internet access into China, because the one thing that Chinese have done as consumers have found a way around censorship in every environment. And so, from my perspective, I don't even think an embargo is wise, because I think we're better off with the access and the ability of people to tap in and find their way around the barriers that the government would impose to be able to gain further access and deeper access to the voices they want to hear, because that's been the experience with China thus far. And the reality is that every time you've opened up an opportunity for someone in China, particularly farther west, not Beijing, Shanghai, the obvious places, what you're really doing is allowing them to differentiate their interests from the state's, and you're actually planting the seeds of political plurality. So if the goal in the context of China is freedom, ultimately, this is a tool. And that tool is better off in place, even with the limitations they think they can impose on it, than not having anything there. So I don't think an embargo would be wise. I also think it would have zero effect if it's focused only on that. To the extent that you were actually going to have an impact, to be honest, it would be as if consumers said to ISPs, if you engage in this kind of collaboration, I'm not going to use your service, and then force the service providers to make a choice about whether they will serve the Chinese government's wishes or serve the broader and richer consumer market, at which point China will face a choice. Because the one thing they know as a government is to stay in power, they have to serve the economic interests of an awful lot of people in China at this point, rising expectations. The Internet is a part of those rising expectations. A market economy functions on information. And today, what creates the modern-day agora, you know, the Greek marketplace from, you know, centuries ago? It's the Internet. And so for information to flow in financial markets, to participate usefully in the global economy, you have to have that access. That might be a leverage point, right? But the fact that it came from consumers rather than from the government would be what would be telling in that context. And the fact that you interrupted the ability of China actually as an economic matter to participate in the global economy by virtue of taking ISPs out by their choice, then you might have an impact. But the idea that you'd impose an embargo just on the Netgear or something like that that would help would have absolutely no impact.
Derek, can I ask you if the same type of debate has occurred in the UK?
No, we don't have this type of debate. And maybe we can get to that as well. But Taiwan makes 75% of everything inside a computer. And in Taiwan, because they're not sure where they're going as a nation, if they are a nation, we won't have that debate. But it's a big issue. But they, of course, they now have as many companies operating in the seaboard part of China as they do in Taipei, because they're sort of, you know, gambling. They don't quite sure where they're going either. But so you can get everything on the internet made in China. I mean, it's made wherever it's made. So it would be a pointless exercise. And I would give a military analogy. When Field Marshal Montgomery had his desert fight against Rommel in the Second World War, he was outclassed, I think, by 9 tanks to 1 and still beat him. And why did he beat him? He got inside the mind of Rommel. It was definitely a 1-to-1 in the battle. It was definitely a 1-to-1. And he beat him because of the cleverness of his tactics. And I think you've got to start to work out the Chinese mind. You've got to start to put yourself where they are. Now listen, they've watched Russia collapse. They've watched Eastern Europe collapse. And it's not a pretty sight, part of Eastern Europe, let me tell you, if you've traveled a bit. Even though some of them are now, you know, first generation in Europe, the cost to Europe's going to be colossal, but we want them in rather than out. So what are you going to do if you're China? Are you going to just say tomorrow democracy? No, you're not. Can you maintain the growth on the eastboard with no growth anywhere else, with no electricity and no water in parts of China? Listen, they know that. They understand that. And they're not going to rush. They never rush. You know, if they get Taiwan in 200 years, you know, they might be putting 800 ballistic missiles ready to shoot the hell out of them, just, you know, frighten them. They'll wait 200 years. And you must understand where they're coming from. That my instinct is they might set up an alternative ICAN. And why shouldn't they? And what would you do if they did? Mm. And would it matter? Well, you've got to start to think what they're thinking. So that's how different I think it is currently.
We're going to go to Andrew in a second, but David, I just want to ask a quick question. Is to what extent has U.S. foreign policy and discussions with the Chinese counterparts, has the issue of liberalizing content and internet freedoms been a policy discussion among the Chinese?
Well, as Grant will attest, for at least as long as we've been in the administration, and I understand it was even before, I just can't speak personally from that. I have had, all I know is every time I go see the minister, and now the second minister for China, he knows my talking points as well as I do, and can recite them right along with me. Now, what impact they have, you know, I actually think they do have some impact, but it would be easy to overstate it, and I'm not naive about it. I don't really want to talk too much about the previous question in part because I'm one of those people who has to testify in about a week on this. But I will sort of remind everybody that China now has 111 million internet subscribers, and obviously a lot more who have access, but 111 million, second largest in the world after the United States. It's not just U.S. search engines and manufacturers. Obviously, Grant and Derek talked about the other manufacturers, but there are homegrown Chinese search engines as well, who I would imagine would love to see the American ones not be able to compete, as any incumbent would like to see foreign competition out of the market when given the choice.
Andrew, Professor Graham, did you want
to? One, would it be a good idea to start using the internet as a weapon of international diplomacy? Absolutely not. Two, the fragmentation that's happening is actually very healthy. And this isn't just about China. It's also about how sites are handled in Pakistan, the Middle East, Germany, the UK, there's variation. In the UK, we have a body called the Internet Watch Foundation, which has been self-regulating on material available to paedophiles. That is something which the UK has done and works quite well. We want to encourage the kind of variation that's possible across cultures. And it's not just across countries, it's across individuals. The Internet allows us to have our own filter levels. So allow it to vary by country, by person. Slowly, it'll get there. Don't force it down.
Well, if I could, one of the things, and maybe, Tom, to answer your question a little bit more directly as well, is we, the U.S. government, do distinguish between those democratic governments that make, on behalf of their people, choices or help, whether it's the sorts of things that Andrew was talking about or other things. All governments do that. And those non-democratic governments that clearly are trying to restrict access in order to hold on to power. And I think that we should, in this debate, it's very important to remember there are certain bright lines, even though there's a lot of gray within certain communities. And I think if we lose sight of that, we will have lost something very significant.
I want to sneak one last thing before we go, which is, Brian, would if China opted out of the current system, what would be the impact from your perspective as a infrastructure provider? I mean, would that be catastrophic to the system? Or?
No, I mean, operating to the original root servers, we operate a piece of that critical infrastructure, and there's a lot of talk and has been a lot of talk about a fractured system and a fractured root. I don't think it would be as catastrophic as some people paint the picture to be. And also, I think a point that came up toward the end of the WSIS process and is certainly going to become more true as we move forward is that putting the issues of free speech and content to the side, there is an enormous amount of economic activity that's moving onto the internet across the globe, so that any country that decides to wall itself off entirely must ultimately face the question of, should I interconnect with the broader internet or not? And there will be a very serious incentive to do so. So I think the threat of fracture from a pure, if I talk to my chief security officer and the engineers, they do not like this notion of a fractured route for a number of reasons. But I think from a political and economic and social standpoint, it's not quite the doomsday scenario that many people suggest.
Just one last thought, which is the weird thing is that rather than fighting this fight as a straight-up issue about free speech, this may be one of those instances where it's better for a Dow Jones to say it's a WTO violation to shut down the ability to deliver market information, because it makes the point in a Chinese community in a very different way. What it's really saying is if you want access to the capital markets and you want a capital market that knows how to price risk, you have to have this constant flow of information into your marketplace. And you signed up for a set of international rules that don't have a doggone thing to do with free speech, but when you engage in censorship, you are violating those trade rules. We'd come at it from a very different angle, but we'd get to the same result, which really is this thing has to remain unfettered. And it's the competition angle, which I think Derek's exactly right. They're so sensitive to the fact that, frankly, they have to have that economic growth for them to stay in power. And so when it comes down to that choice about what you do while security will trump economics, the one place where I know economics will trump security is when you say ultimately you won't deliver on the promise economically unless you allow this thing to remain free, then the choice will likely be to keep it free.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Annick Lacroix from Statistics Canada. I have a very different kind of question to ask to the panel, and which I think is really relevant, is what do you see as really the role of the internet for developing countries? Do you see, because with everything that I've heard up to now is really concentrated on the U.S. and developed countries and problems related to, you know, the use of internet in developed countries. But we see that with the developing countries are starting to get quite interested on the internet. However, you have most of the population in the world is completely illiterate. You have this big also gender divide that is really present. And how realistic is it to see the internet growing in areas where people are completely illiterate? In China is a good example. Yes, there's millions of people using the internet. On the other hand, in China, you have even more people who do not have water, do not have electricity, are illiterate. So what do you see as the role of the internet to help develop those countries? And what do you see you can do to help
I think you have almost every single one up on this panel who wants to answer that question.
We want to be first.
Sure. Yeah. So let's go with Derek as a start, because I like him best.
Our Prime Minister has created the Africa Commission. In 1964, the GDP of Africa was exactly the same as China. just hold that for a moment. Not many years ago, we're tired of failing Africa. So we've set up a commission to look at what are the issues and how to resolve them. One of the papers I wrote for the commission was an internet school. Now, with the Google $100 laptop, which incidentally is being made in Taipei, which I saw in January, you saw it at WSIS if you were there, all you need actually is cheap solar energy to power information classrooms. And you can actually start the literacy. It's the health. How do you do the malaria for Bill Gates if they can't read the things? Well, they can't read the things, so we won't. We've got to start with the languages. We've got to teach them the languages, and then the healthcare will follow. We've got to put in place a sort of open university for the internet. Now, the open university, which is a British invention, has so far got through 5 million graduates in Africa. The 23 of the 25 cabinet members in Ethiopia have MBAs from the open university, and the president, Nelesh, got the third highest MBA result ever. And that was after 18 years of fighting each other.
I'm going to turn it to Brian, but I'm going to have to make an apology to the gentleman because I know we're going to run out of time. So forgive me in advance for that. Brian, you had a response.
Sure. I think that's the best question of the day. As a participant in the WSIS process, I think the big story out of WSIS was the enormous missed opportunity, waste of years and money and time, not focusing on that issue, which was supposed to be the central issue in the process. And those of us at the back of the bus kept waving our hands saying, wait a minute, guys, it's not about control and the U.S. government's role and this silly contract for IANA. It's about developing countries and how do we expand the infrastructure. Just basic educational points. The root server system, there's only 13, there's an algorithmic limitation. Guess what? There's about 130 mirrors. That number's likely to double in about 3 years. The infrastructure is expanding into developing countries. That's the story we need to get out there. Making sure those markets are open so that new forms of gear, Wi-Fi access, the component parts, that's all they care about. They really don't care, and as a matter of priority, about content and speech issues and democracy. They just want to get at the thing. Okay. That's where we need to focus.
So we're going to go to David, and I know each panelist wants to do it, and then we'll probably have to wrap up.
Let me give you a slightly more optimistic view. But agreeing with all that has been said before, including the missed opportunity, I thought, the summit. But I also saw at the summit an extraordinary thing, as I did in the first phase of the summit. I mean, it is truly extraordinary to see the developing world, what is happening, particularly by NGOs and by indigenous groups, in which they are using the technology in ways that are extraordinary to bring services and education and healthcare and other things to people who never before had that opportunity. I would note that the two fastest growing areas of internet growth in the world is Africa and the Middle East. I take a lot of comfort in that fact. Part of that is because of some of the things that Grant talked about, which is countries around the world are recognizing the internet access is not a luxury but a necessity. It's also in part because of changes in technology, lower costs, and some of the things that Derek was talking about. But it was also, we've worked very hard, as have our European colleagues, particularly in the UK, in trying to work with governments to understand what it means to have an enabling environment. To have the internet requires infrastructure. Infrastructure doesn't grow up by itself overnight. It takes an enabling environment that requires rule of law, requires an attractive set of laws for foreign direct investment, whether it's the United States, we rely on that, all countries do, particularly in those parts of the world require that. And it takes an understanding about what the opportunities are and the importance of that. I think we're seeing that. We need to do much more. We spend a lot of time, a lot of energy, and frankly a lot of money to do that. There's a lot more to be done. But I see it much more optimistically. I see a sea change. If you combine internet access with wireless access, which again has exploded, we have over 2 billion cell phones. And the sort of thing, when you talk about literacy issues, it's remarkable. That's a significant problem. Wireless, in terms of cell phones, helps solve some of those problems by giving people access and be able to communicate. And it's exploded in the same areas you see internet exploding now in the developing world.
Okay, we're going to go to Grant and then let Professor Graham wrap it up.
Perfect segue from what David was talking about, because the answering part to the language problem is internet telephony and wireless. Think about it this way. In the WTO, we're having a huge debate about cotton subsidies in the United States. Four West African countries are saying the biggest obstacle to us gaining any market share are U.S. cotton subsidies. And yet, if you talk with anybody who actually farms in West Africa about the amount of money the middleman takes in any transaction, what you suddenly understand is we could eliminate our cotton subsidy programs and it would mean nothing to the farmer. What you really need is a cell phone and the access to the internet that gives you information about prices, information about demand, and information about who else you could bargain with to sell your goods, in which case it's about the market power. And that market power is something you can access without actually having written language through internet telephony, which of course drops the cost of this to near nothing. And my point in saying that actually peels all the way back. You know, the thinking in development has changed. I know what Jeff Sachs says. He represents an old school, which is there is a capital gap in development that has to be filled by foreign assistance. And foreign assistance to governments, not individual entrepreneurs, not people who actually create value. That has failed us for 60 years. We're now in a position when we look at this where guys like Nobel laureate Mark Dissen, when he talks about development, he talks about giving individuals the capacity to create economic change in their own lives. If that's the model, the single greatest tool is the internet and wireless. Because suddenly you have a woman who can run a fish pond in Kenya, and she can have access to a restaurant in Nairobi where she doesn't need refrigeration. She just gets on the phone and says, what fish do you need tonight? Right? And pulls it out of the pond, sends it off to Nairobi. She's made some money off that and improved the prospects for her life. A woman-owned business in that context. And that's the model of development that will work. Sadly, the framework we have on trade and the GATT, the WTO, and worst of all, I hate to say it, the World Bank, is completely antithetical to the power that this could bring. Why? Because it enables governments that are corrupt, let's be honest about this, to stay in power rather than to cede power economically to the individuals who create wealth. And the one thing that can level that is communications at the end of the day. That's what I think the real power of the net is in a developing context.
That's a neat point.
Sorry.
No, that was excellent. Andrew, please, we'll let you wrap it up.
3 points. I'm an economist.
That's great.
And there are two things that I know and one thing that I make a guess about. The one thing that I really know is that technology is one of the real long-run forces for economic growth, and it raises the average income level. That we know. The second question, all the studies of development, we have no real idea about what technology does to income distribution between countries and within countries. We don't know whether it equalizes it or not. It's incredibly complicated. Just to give you an example of why can sometimes bringing countries together through technology, India was an extremely rich country until the Lancashire cotton mills got going. Sometimes industries get wiped out, and it's very bad news for particular people. So the income distribution can do this, it can do this, I don't know. It does all you can't say. What's my intuition? My intuition is that this technology is going to help those countries that have already made it to the first run. India, some of the Latin American countries, they're going to make it because they've got the basic education skills and some of the other skills you need to take it. Africa, and I mean, of course, Africa isn't the whole, you know, it's all got to be massively differentiated between all sorts of different countries within it. But I was in Ethiopia, and you know, it's half a mile to the nearest road. Yeah, the notion they'd have a mobile phone just doesn't exist. So a lot of countries are still going to be, they're probably going to go further behind. So I see the emerging countries catching up and some of the others losing. That's just a guess. We really don't know. But we do know it'll raise everybody slowly, gradually.
Thank you, Andrew. Quick programming note before we say thank you to our panelists. One, there's an initiative being showcased in the tech fair area called One Web Day. And it's about September 22nd and using it to help collaborate online to help people who might not otherwise be able to get that kind of help. So I heartily encourage you to go over there, grab a pen, grab some information about it, and learn about it. It seems like a very neat idea. And do it, if anything, because Susan Crawford's a good person. So two things. One, you can't have a good panel without great questions from the audience, so thank you very much from the audience. I want to thank Brian and Andrew and David and Derek and Grant for really opening up and not being shy about explaining where they're at.
And so I want to thank them very much.